All right, here we are. Just as the creation story started in darkness, our human creation story starts in the uterine waters, dark in the middle of the womb, where the first spark of life begins when that sperm and egg are joined. And a sudden froth of cells emerges, just pop, and they begin with a beat. The heart forms first, and everything else emerges from it and follows its rhythms. A tiny thread of spine follows out of the heart that blooms into brain and eye and becomes lungs and organs. And then sturdy little gills and flippers. Remember, we were fish before we became mammal. Remnants of gills are found in our own human lungs. And the limbs of the early mammals soon differentiate into the two arms and two legs of the human. We go through all the stages of planetary evolution in the womb. And voila, the fifth and sixth day of creation are wrapped up in a blanket and put in its mother's arms. Under that cap, there are the three brains that emerged in epoch after epoch, but just fast-forwarded into human form in the womb. The fish stage, the mammal stage, and the human stage. Each of those brains lies on top of and wraps around its earlier predecessor. In that sweet little skull under that knitted cap lie three totally different structures of cells and intelligence, each firing away with his own agenda and packed together in one small carrying case. It takes about 2 years to get the hang of those three brains physically. This infant will sort of swim in the air for several months and then onto its belly, squirming like its lizard stage, then crawling on all fours of the mammal stage, and then around age two, upright, triumphant, and ready to roll. New voices are telling this creation story. The outlines of it have emerged from 50 years of biological and neurological research, much of it happening at the National Institute of Health, which has now grown into 27 institutes. In the 1970s, a team of scientists under Dr. Paul MacLean identified for the first time out of the mass of just sort of nameless gray matter that we've always assumed was the brain, they were the first to begin to separate out and identify these three brains in one, and they named them the triune brain. I got to know Paul MacLean a little in the mid-80s because we both served for about a week at a wonderful summit in education in Washington, D.C. He was brilliant, but he was one of the funniest men I've ever known, and he needed that humor because he had to stand fast with his breakthrough discoveries that were getting a lot of pushback from the beginning. But let's make a model of our own brain with our own fist. If you'll just take one of your hands up like this, you can follow the little drawing up on the screen. Pull your thumb across your palm and close the top of your fingers over it. And you have a relatively good replica of the brain in your head, just a little smaller. Turn your fist forward and examine your wrist as it comes up into the bottom saddle of your palm. That's not a bad representation of the reptilian brainstem. Open your fingers for a minute and take a peek at your thumb, which is curled inside, sandwiched between the two brains, bottom and top. That's the brain that emerged with the mammal stage, and this is the position that it holds in your brain. Now, everything's been growing up there. It's bigger and bigger so that it can't keep going up or out. It has to curl in, crumple over these old brains, and that's your neocortex. So we're going to take a little look at these three brains. Here is the triune brain, and we're going to begin where your wrist begins, with the brain stem. This is the reptilian complex, the brain of the body, the ultimate survival system, and because it all runs automatically. For instance, if you had to remember to breathe this morning or to keep your eyes open, arms and legs online and working, Well, this is because it's your body brain at work. But not only does the body run on these automatic signals, so do its behaviors. For this old brain, mating is run by the timing of the seasons. The young are born in eggs, deposited in a safe place where, like robots, they incubate and hatch by themselves, living and dying according to the circumstances around them. There is no relationship here. It's a limited automatic intelligence that works only to survive. It's only me against all other, and the rest of the world is other. Humans, too, survive physically and socially by these old brain rules. Our lives are run by them. But in terms of behavior, we tend to call them habits, where we keep doing the same thing automatically, over and over again. We say the same thing. We think the same thoughts. We have the same reactions. Habits, legacy of our old brain. Automatic routines run our lives, whole clusters of habits that we do the same way every day. I think all of you have your own unique way of brushing your teeth, of the order in which you get dressed, the manner in which you put on the smile, straighten your shoulders, and greet someone. These are the routines that are automatic and run your lives. But for very important occasions, routines turn into formal rituals and are done with great care and ceremony. Think weddings. Think winning the Olympic Games. Think worship in church. Now, the great strategy for protection in the ancient brain, and you're now running down this little chart toward the bottom, the great strategy for this ancient brain is the strategy of deception. Think mother quail with her broken wing, dragging herself away from her young so that the predator will be deceived. Think of a chameleon whose skin is madly changing colors and spots to match his background. Think of the little Izod polo shirts that were popular years ago with the little lizard logo on them. I used to think that the old brain really knew how to play the market with that one. The original function of deception, however, is good. It's to keep everyone safe and secure. But in an environment of difficulty and threat, the fight or flight brain takes over. Its biochemical states of alarm trump everything else that's happening, and we automatically react. We automatically react often with deception. It's not something we figure out. It's something that we are prompted to do. St. Paul lamented in his letter to the Romans, "I can will what is right, but I often cannot do it. For I do not do the good I want, but the evil I don't want, I find myself doing." We all tussle with those ingrained reactions of our oldest brain. And the curious thing is that in our affluent and safe culture, we still love the rush of the fight state. Much of our entertainment and all our video games court violence. Our brains are bathed in an infusion of cortisol, and we live unnecessarily with a form of floating anxiety. Eric Fromm, after all, called our time the age of anxiety. Well, back to our fist. And now we've moved up to the little structure inside these two brains, the limbic system, or the mammalian brain. This is the structure of intelligence that was called into being when a whole new body type evolved to incubate the young in the body and to care for them after birth until they could fend for themselves. This midbrain produced a whole new system of emotional social intelligence, and it's all based on relationship. It included forming family and tribal bonds. And those kinds of bondings generalized to include a bond and connection to the environment that produced a kind of ongoing noticing and interest in what was going on. That interest and noticing became a basis of learning. It produced cellular structures in the amygdala and hippocampus to retain what was noticed and learned. We call it memory. The midbrain produced the beginning of selfhood, recognizing a me and a you, an us and a them. It elevated the old brain's robot-like sensory system to a whole new level. At this level, the sense of smell becomes the keenest that it is at any point in our evolution. It certainly became the dog's main perceptual system, as it did many animals. It became, across species, a trigger for sex. Think also of the allure of the smell of cooking. This is a very highly developed sense, and its highest development comes from this brain. This brain also elevated the automatic hearing and sound capacities of the lizard world into capacities for chirping and buzzing, of listening, a proto-language that in our own brain becomes a powerhouse of intelligence. And finally, sight, vision itself, which is minimal in the reptilian brain, becomes a major optical program that will be the bottom of a huge functioning system that runs the human brain. With this brain, the automatic intelligence of the old brain evolves to become a personal instinct for living and caring in relationship, in noticing and learning and remembering. And in the absence of threat, which was most of the time, the chief interactions between the old mammalian kingdom were spent in a state of play. The great gift of the midbrain is the formation of family. As the main element of survival and development, family systems remain the primary organizing pattern with the old brain and in the new brain. It's the basis of all our roles, all our social status, our hierarchy, and our authority. But over the eons, a final cranial structure emerged to become our third brain. Now the fingers come over the top, and there we have the top knot, a very big top knot on top of the older two brains. It's an intelligence that stands outside the physical and survival systems of those hind brains, and it's hugely larger than both of them together. It goes far beyond that noticing and remembering of the midbrain. This brain is able to think about what's happening. There's that great big green structure. See how it dwarfs everything else. It thinks about what's happening, and it's able to respond, not automatically or out of the bonds of duty, but specifically and uniquely to whatever's going on in the moment. A look at the evolution of our skulls gives us a clue to the brain expanding and growing forward. Finally, there was just so much brain matter that it had to crumple inside our skull. It couldn't get much bigger, and it's crammed together into folds and lobes. The new brain is divided into two separate lobes, which are connected by the corpus callosum. The left hemisphere gets all the same information that's flowing to the base brain and the midbrain, but it separates it into specifics, thinking about things through language and numbers with all their combinations and meanings. But it only connects to the right hemisphere. There is no connection to the other two brains. This hemisphere is relatively isolated, very little input from the larger intelligence of the whole brain. The right hemisphere gathers the same information that the rest of the brains in the body are getting, but it makes meaning out of them through patterns and images, color, line, and space. It imagines and creates. It's connected to the left hemisphere, but it is also richly connected to the older brains. This is the brain of wholeness. And at the top of the neocortex, up here, lie the executive functions. This is where all our planning and reasoning and logic and organizing takes place. It's an extraordinary powerhouse of abilities. So here's our whole brain. All three brains are interdependent, although they have a separate cellular structure. They have a role, a constant role, in each other's productions. 30 years ago, Harvard researcher Howard Gardner called the combined function of the three brains our multiple intelligence. And he concluded that this is what we have operating with this whole big three-brain system: a verbal intellectual intelligence, a logical mathematical one, a visual spatial one, a bodily kinesthetic intelligence, musical intelligence, social intelligence, and finally, and this is not well developed by Gardner, but he identifies an intra, that is, internal personal intelligence that clearly he has not done much research in, but interestingly, it was the last of the pieces of research that came out of McLean's team in the late 70s. McLean's team discovered that at the front of these prefrontals, the very front of the front, right where the forehead is, a whole new set of circuitries that had never been identified before existed, were ready to have a switch thrown on them. He called them the angel brain. It was a whole new set of circuitries that processed the same information stream that's going to the body brain, the social brain, the thinking brain, the creating brain. But it reads, this frontal brain reads it very differently. It reads it much, with a much bigger bandwidth. It's able to read much more of the truth and that's actually going on. When the prefrontals are activated, we literally know how someone else feels because there is a circuitry for empathy. And all our responses will naturally play out through the circuitries of compassion. We can gather information from a distance, the circuitries of telepathy, and outside time, precognition. We can understand the meaning and implications of what's before us instantly without having the left brain figure it out with reason, because we can use the circuitries of intuition and insight, all in the prefrontals. These are a direct line to the presence of the Creator. God's evolution always moves for greater intelligence. The neocortex occupies 5 times more space than the combined old brains. It consists of 100 billion neurons, each of which interact with at least 100,000 other neurons. In short, there are no limits to what this third brain can translate from its outer inputs into thought and imagination. And with the addition of these prefrontal circuitries, we're looking at a humanity designed to be, as Psalm 8 says, a little lower than the angels. Oops, I went the wrong way. Over the years, I've come to think of these potentials of the front prefrontal brain as the gifts of Pentecost. I imagine how the disciples, who I believe had learned how to move into and stay in a heart alignment that uses all of these brains as Jesus taught and indeed modeled. At that point, when the great field in which they had lived and learned left them, the field that was left downloaded at Pentecost with these extraordinary abilities that are described so well in Scripture, they were able to instantly translate all the information of the moment into the truths that were needed with the language, with the healing, with the connections that were required, and it changed the world. However, since then, very few have been able to activate those angel brain circuitries. We've certainly been supplied with a model of this plan for the Creator. The Church has studied and talked about it for 2,000 years. But knowing about it isn't enough. The switch for this level of intelligence is not automatic. It's not emotional. It's not intellectual. It can only be thrown by awareness and intention within a positive emotional state. Negative experience of any kind causes a shift of energy away from the forebrain to the hindbrain and its defenses. Our brilliant third brain is like Cinderella, who flourished in childhood's play but found her adulthood compromised by her negative family and the culture and the uneven development of the people around her. But hobbled as it is, humanity has cleverly managed to co-opt much of its blueprint for development. Our new brain, bringing its math and science and creativity, serves the needs of the anxious old brains. And it has produced a sparkling array to assuage their angst and their fear. We have an extraordinary record of achievement in technologies that remind me of the sorcerer's apprentice. We are acting with abandon, making whatever we can dream of without the guidance of the larger intelligence with which we've been endowed. So back to the brain labs in the 1990s, where a last new brain was discovered, hidden inside the heart. Now, we already knew a lot about the heart. It was the master pump that oxygenates and circulates our blood, keeps us alive. We learned how to handle the plumbing and blockages pretty well. We know it's the master oscillator, that the rhythms of every cell follow its beat. But in the early 90s, it was discovered that a lot of those cells were brain cells, whose long ganglia connected directly to the brain, up to the vagus nerve. It was big news to science, but frankly, it was old news to the ancients, who knew that the heart was the center of being, that it was the seat of the soul, the gateway to the presence of God. The mystic Saint Theophan the Recluse was famous for teaching, "Let the mind descend into the heart. There is the entry hall to God." And it turns out to be the literal truth of the brain-heart connection. The surprising truth was that the heart is the electromagnetic core of the body. Now, we're just beginning to grapple with the physicist's discovery that the entire universe is made of energy, that the body, too, is made of energy. Each heart cell, besides its other duties, emits an electromagnetic wave of energy. Each beat of the heart sends out a wave of about 5 watts of energy, and it helps make energetic fields of information that are invisible, but carried by energy frequencies around the body. 3 fields of energy have been identified and measured around the body, one at about 3 feet around the body, another around 6, another around 12 to 15 feet. You've been sitting in each other's literal presences in ways that you had no idea. And information is constantly, though, beneath your level, your threshold of awareness, being swapped in this room. An amazing thing is happening. Now, this is similar to the great torus of energy that surrounds the Earth. Earth herself emits a measurable wave beat of energy that we can pick up and hear, set about 7 hertz. But her field is enormously complex. We're only at the bare beginning of this energetic universe. But here's what we do know about the work of the heart. In addition to its physical job, the brain cells of the heart have been found to operate on another level of communication through electromagnetic frequencies. And we just call those EM. It's just a little shortcut for electromagnetic. In the world outside physics, frequency is simply the rate at which things happen. Tick-tock, tick-tock. But within the energetic universe, frequency is the rate at which a vibration occurs, like a sound wave, or in the electromagnetic field, radio waves, light waves that are usually measured per second. Our heart cells were found to receive and transmit information by means of resonant frequencies. An enormous range of information is embedded in these frequencies that are emitted and received by the heart, far beyond the mere information of the body. Because the heart's fields are active within the Earth's fields of subtle information, and the Earth's torus pulses within the fields of the solar system, and the solar system with the unfathomable energies of the deep universe. So this is how our logo for this series really developed. Our own heart is energetically connected with the vast waves of information within the heart of the cosmos. Now this is real breath of God stuff. And it's the reason we titled the series, The Spiritual Heart. Now these frequencies are in play in ways that you've already met them. Some of you have had EKG charts, and this is what it looks like. This is what your frequencies look like. Or perhaps an EEG chart. These are brain waves measured in the brain. But it turns out that the heart's frequencies are higher than the brain's. They trump the brain. The heart is the alpha member of this partnership. And when these frequencies from the heart are received, the brain ups its own functions. And the high programs of the prefrontals begin to be available. But this high wire functioning only occurs within a positive emotional state. When our hind brains are peaceful, this is where the work of another group of visionaries and scientists on the West Coast enter the picture. I first encountered the work of HeartMath in the Santa Cruz Mountains in the late 90s when they were just about to launch their big corporate programs that taught the matching up of heart and brain frequencies. And found that it was this little group that began to start working deliberately with this peaceful state of the hind brains. First of all, you have to know that this peaceful state of your hind brains occurs once a day. It's when you're asleep. And the story here comes from the survival brain. It has something called an autonomic system, remember, all automatic, that is responsible for two opposite physical responses. The sympathetic nervous system prepares the body for that intense activity of the fight or flight response. The parasympathetic nervous system has almost the exact opposite of effect. It relaxes the body. It inhibits a lot of those high energy functions, and it paves the way for more information to be processed than can possibly be processed in an emergency. HeartMath found that when people are awake and in a positive mood, their bodies shift into a parasympathetic mode. The hindbrains stay peaceful. And when we use the intention of our neocortex and some deliberate, slow breathing, our heart waves and brain waves automatically come into sync. The HeartMath folks developed a brilliant but simple biofeedback system that reads a person's variable heart rate, which shows a clear signal of the person's emotional state. Most of us live in a state of mind of mild to serious anxiety. The upper chart is what this looks like. The hind brains are active here, and they're calling the shots. But when we deliberately recall a happy, positive experience, and then generate and hold the feelings of that safe, joyful time, a different heart signature shows up in the lower chart. Look at those even peaks and troughs. When this is happening, it facilitates a lot higher brain function. And when the heart can generate this steady state, positive mode, its frequencies draw the rest of the brain's waves into a matching pattern. Everything is in sync. The name of this fused state is called heart coherence. And with practice, heart coherence can be sustained as a working state. And then the brain function can really begin to get into gear. Just as a rising tide lifts all boats, a coherent heart-brain state lifts the function of all our brains. The three brains cooperate through these subtle resonance frequencies, and they're all pulled into alignment, all onto the same wavelength. I think that this is the brain state that Jesus occupied and that he was teaching his disciples and us. Here's an example. We know this commandment so well, Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, soul, mind, and strength. And the second one is like it. You will love your neighbor as yourself. There are no greater commandments than these. Well, that state of heart coherence may create the inner climate that allows our clumsy attempts at caring and being good to come into sync with the forebrain's programs of where it really happens. All those circuitries guarantee it. And we'll find ourselves equipped with an actual ability to be in another's shoes and to love one another as, what do you know, we accept and care for ourselves without judgment. The most frequent commandment that appears in the Bible, at least 70 times by some counts, is be not afraid. It's not this gentle little pat on the head that parents give their children. Oh, it's okay, be not afraid. It is a literal function. Jesus said, let not your heart be troubled, neither let it be afraid, over and over. Julian of Norwich affirms that positive, steady state with her own heart warming, all shall be well, and all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well. Yes, it means that the hind brains are idling and happy, and that the way is cleared for you to work forward without any hindrance whatsoever. We are the creation story on two legs. We are walking holograms of the planet. We have a pattern of the Earth's evolution in our own cells. There is a blueprint in our brains of the Creator's design for personal and planetary and cosmos evolution. Transcendence isn't just a theological idea. Our own biology is an agent of transformation and transcendence. So we are just about ready for a break, but I'd like to take 5 minutes at the end now and translate all of this just for a moment into a little session that allows you to perhaps get in touch with what I've just been talking about. These are exciting ideas. And we kind of can follow it, all right? And much of this information is not new to this group. But I can remember when I first put my feet on this path that I had a bit of a challenge in actually thinking that these invisible resonant energies really held information that I could, number one, sense, and number two, draw on for some information for my own use. So I'm going to have you try to get in touch just a little bit with the shimmer of energy that is available and constantly in your own body that you can just feel. And I'm going to start by asking you to put down whatever notes you were taking and free up your hands. Put your palms together like this and rub very briskly for as long as I'm talking to you. Rub so you make a real friction between these palms. They should be beginning to get warm back and forth, rubbing these palms. And pull them apart and just concentrate on what you feel in your fingers. Can you feel that resonance? Yes. Now push your palms together and out, back and forth, until your palms can actually feel a little resistance. That is energy field. Just experiment with it. Some of you can pull your palms way apart, still feel it. Some have to have them closer together. Just wherever you can actually honestly feel it. Now, while your hands are still sensitive like this, bring them close slowly toward your head. Very slowly, and you can feel with your eyes closed especially, which puts you in that parasympathetic mode. With your eyes closed, you can feel the approach of your hands. Feel it. with the surface of your skin. And your face and temples can feel the approach of your hands. So out and then in again so you can feel that approach. Go to the top of your head gently. A lot of hair there, harder to feel. Go down to your neck, you can feel it there. Especially go to your heart, your chest. Out and in until you honestly can feel that little shimmer of energy. You're touching a field that's carrying an unfathomable amount of energy and information. You can move your hands and perhaps do this experiment at home. Just try checking your feet, your legs. But for the wrap-up of this experiment, put your hands together again in your lap. And if you haven't done so yet, you may wish to close your eyes, because, as I say, this facilitates that peaceful place Tom was just asking about. Adding breath is the other part of this energy sensing and energy existence is very important. So I'm going to ask you to take a few deep belly breaths with me together. A deep breath in for the count of four. And out, two, three, four. In, two, three, four. Out, two, three, four, five. And in, two, three, four. Out, two, three, four, five. In. And as you begin to pick up that rhythm, deep rhythm, letting your belly go soft and opening and pushing the breath in, out and receiving it in, I want you to put your hand on your heart and imagine yourself breathing that breath through your heart and then out through your heart. You may want to remove your hand just 2 or 3 inches from your chest, from your heart, and you may actually be able to feel a bit of the energy there as you breathe in through your heart and out through your heart. And now here's where we add our beautiful new brain. You're bringing now deliberately the thought of all of the wonderful information and possibility that we've been listening to this morning. Breathe in and you just can sense a kind of gratitude for this group and this opportunity in this place, in this country. Breathe in and just let that swell of gratitude fill your heart and pour out on the out-breath as a blessing back to this place that is holding us in the palm of its hand. And in again, with such gratitude for your life, whatever occurs to you to be grateful for, bring it in. Then breathe out the blessing for it. And imagine that blessing breathing out into the fields of all these people around you that you now know are there waiting. Then in, such gratitude. Out, that blessing surrounds everyone in this room. In such gratitude. And out. And we've pulsed to include the whole room with our blessing. And in with gratitude. And then out. And the whole block is filled with blessing all around this church. And in with gratitude. And then out. Cover the whole neighborhood, all the fields that we know are there, with blessing, deliberate, and in and out to cover Santa Barbara with blessing, and in and out to throw an energetic field around the whole county In, gratitude, out, and throw your loop as wide as you can. And in with gratitude, and one more great cast of the loop of blessing to the fields that are pulsing all around us. And then with the next breaths, begin to bring the blessing back in a little closer, and then out to bless it, and in, bring it in a little closer. Perhaps you're now down the state of California. Out again with blessing, in again with Santa Barbara, out with blessing, in with the circumference of this beautiful church, out with blessing, in to this room, out with blessing, in now just for our own personal gratitude for the life that has been given to us, and out with an amen. Now, just sit for a moment and see if you can feel a little shimmer, just the slightest quickening around you or in your body. You'll feel it somewhere. It's present. You've ignited just a bit of it with this exercise. Now, these are what we ordinarily call the gestures of piety, bringing hands together, thinking about God, being grateful, opening our eyes now to see everyone around us. It's what we do in church. It's what we do at home. But far beyond mere pious gestures of the body and the thought, these are actual functions of spiritual intelligence, so that belief becomes functional when we begin to operate at this level of the creation story. So I think it's time now to take our break. Wonderful food awaits, and when you come back in, you'll come in on yet another set of frequencies that you'll find when Tom brings us back in with the Sound of Music. I'll see you in 20. Thank you.